the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
And a very good afternoon, and Michael Condon here with you, and Emily Middleton as well. And we're broadcasting today from the Renewables in Ag Conference here in Orange, Emily, and it's a pretty packed house.
It is, full, almost full house. It's full of plenty of fantastic conversations here around renewable energy and some of the challenges, also some of the fantastic things that can be, that people are doing.
Mm, and we also heard from Minister Penny Sharp as well. She made some interesting points about the uptake in regional Australia.
She did. She was saying that one in three households, not in regional Australia, just in Australia as a whole, have taken up rooftop solar, and in the regions 40% have rooftop solar, which I just thought was fascinating. There's a clear interest in that uptake of renewable energy across the nation.
We'll also be talking about the climate science as well shortly with Mark Howden from ANU, and also about the economics with Andrew Whitelaw, who was saying, you know, he says you know, if you don't believe or not, doesn't matter. He says there's economic reasons to look at it, to look at renewables.
Absolutely, a way to sort of to support yourself beyond you know your typical, you know, grazing enterprise or whatnot. There are lots of different opportunities that people can take up
Beyond food and fibre and extra farm income and thinking about those things. So we'll hear from Andrew Whitelaw shortly as well in about half an hour's time. But first up, yes, the New South Wales Energy Minister Penny Sharp. She was at this conference. She was talking about the state government's renewable energy rollout and the new ag tech program. Farmers in the Central West Arana Renewable Energy Zone, they'll soon be able to apply for some grants, she was saying, to purchase agricultural technology under a $1.4 million smart farming program. But she also couldn't escape some questions about trust or lack thereof in the energy shift when Minister Sharp fronted a press conference earlier. But first, she detailed this morning's announcement.
So there's some really great water infrastructure being supported throughout sort of Central West Arana. There's roads. We're going to be dealing with a whole range of other things. But the announcement I made today really is about farmers, for farmers, and something that they've been asking for. Within the renewable energy zones, $1.4 million in a grants program that will help people with the upfront costs of smart tech on their farms. There's over 900 products that actually are considered smart tech, but it's things like water sensors. It's really about being able to connect up your farm to make it electric, to make it, be able to pull all of the information from the internet, AI, all of those things to help run farms more efficiently. So this is support for farmers. They'll be able to apply for a grant up to $35,000 to help them put some better tech on their farm.
We've seen the first wind turbine blades arrive in Wellington this week. How important is this step for the Central West Arana RES?
Look, it's extremely important. I mean, the Central West Arana RES, 40 towers of the transmission lines are literally up as we speak. But the real reason that they're there is to make sure that we can have the renewable energy generation in place. We've got a lot of good solar and batteries that are happening in this area. Wind is the key to that. Seeing the first turbine makes you realise what big the task is, but very welcome. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, obviously, in the next decade or so as all of that rolls out. But exciting to see, but also points to some of the challenges. How do we actually manage roads so that they don't impact on locals? How do we upgrade roads along the route? How do we really work with that? And there's a lot of effort being made into doing that. Probably seeing the first turbine makes you realise how big they are.
The Clean Energy Investor Group, they found that New South Wales takes the longest and is the most expensive process to get renewable energy projects approved. Why is that the case, and what impact has that had on the rollout of the Central West Arana RES?
Look, it's been way too slow. We inherited wind guidelines that really were designed to make building wind farms as hard as possible. There's been a huge amount of work in the 3 years that I've been the minister and within the Minns government to really try and streamline that. We've done a lot of work around guidelines and processes within planning to try and speed that up. We are seeing more projects being approved and coming out of the system, which is very welcome. There's always work to be done. I've currently got a piece of legislation in the Parliament that would actually help us prioritise some of these projects. I hope it goes through, but we're not there yet.
You touched on this in your speech a bit about the opposition to the renewables rollout. How are you able to overcome that when in this region, for example, and in closer to Mudgee, there's been the destruction of habitats and also Indigenous sacred sites. How do you overcome opposition from both anti-renewables groups, but also, in that case, environmentalists as well?
Look, we just have to be serious. This infrastructure needs to be built. We've actually got in New South Wales what I consider actually a world-leading plan to do it. But we're also doing it very quickly. When you do things quickly, things go wrong, and we need to improve on that all the time. To go specifically to people who are opposed to the rollout, I think that there is a small but very loud group that's there. I think the vast majority of the community are curious. They want to know that it's being done properly. They want to understand what it means for their communities. And they're starting to see some of that through the community benefits funding that we're there. In relation to the rock shelter, that was something that should never have happened. It's something that I am genuinely appalled by. We cannot say to communities, we cannot say to First Nations communities that we will look after your heritage and then have something like that happen. I've actually hauled in both the chair and the CEO of ACERES in relation to this. There have been some significant changes as a result of this particular incident, and I would expect that they don't happen again. We cannot build trust with communities if we don't do what we say we're going to do.
Three unauthorised vehicles drove off the public road through very clearly signed no public access signs, unlatched a back gate and drove through an employee's house yard at Waverley Station in the Upper Hunter. How do you plan to restore trust after the scathing RES inquiry report and now this that's happened?
Well, the contractor that did that's been sacked, so that's the first thing that we've done. But look, the most important thing, as I said before, we have to do what we say we're going to do. We have to do it with the utmost transparency. When things go wrong, we have to apologise, and we have to make sure that we do everything in our place to make sure it doesn't happen again. This is not a good incident. It's not something that I'm happy about. It's not something that... and I've been very clear with Energy Co in relation to these matters. But these are complex projects, and people need to do better, and we will do it, but people will also be held accountable for when they do the wrong thing.
Minister for Climate Change, Energy and Environment, Penny Sharp there. And in a statement, Energy Co acknowledges that a contractor mistakenly did enter onto private land while completing work for the New England Renewable Zone. And Energy Co's policy is to only access private land with approval from the landholder and to respect and follow any conditions of entry that they request. And we deeply they deeply regret that a contractor did not follow Energy Co's policy in this instance, and they have apologised to the landholder for the mistaken entrance onto their property. And you're listening to The Country Hour at the moment. I'm Emily Middleton. I'm here with Michael Condon. We're broadcasting live from the Renewables in Agriculture Conference here in Orange. And joining us now is Karen Stark, the...
organisers, the long-term organiser.
Yes, as well as director of Farm Renewables Consultancy. She lives on a cotton farm and wheat farm near Narromine, and she joins us now.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, take us back to this journey. I mean, when it all started, and the impetus for you to get involved. I remember the first occasion, actually.
Yes. Michael has been doing his outside broadcasts every single conference that's been in New South Wales since 2019. So appreciate the support. So really, it started out of understanding that our pumping costs about $300,000 in diesel to pump water over summer for our cotton was quite substantial, one of our biggest input costs. And because I've got a background in environmental science and I work for state government around renewable energy, understanding that the cost of solar had come down about 80% over the last 8 to 10 years meant that the business case was a lot stronger for us to replace some of that diesel with solar during the day and pumping with diesel overnight. So we ended up putting a solar diesel pump in 2018. That was meant to be a 5-year payback, cutting 500 tonnes of emissions out of the atmosphere every year. That's really exciting. And it worked quite well for the first year. However, we experienced substantial problems following that and haven't really been able to use the pump as intended. But that understanding that renewables can really start to give energy independence, energy security and reduce costs for farmers was the impetus for us to, or for me to bring this conference together. And it's really a way for different perspectives to also come together. We've got government, industry, business, farmers, peak bodies. You know, we all need to be working together for solutions to bring down the cost of farmers and also in the broader energy transition.
Yeah, and I guess, so, and you made that point there that the path isn't always smooth, and quite often there's hiccups along the way, but you're still committed to the overall goal.
Yeah, I mean, for first movers in agriculture, there wasn't a lot of support for us. And I think being the biggest of its kind in Australia in 2018, substantial issues without having a battery as part of our solar diesel pump. So these challenges are something that are shared at these conferences like this so that we can all learn from each other. The conference very much asks farmers to come on stage and talk about what they've done, what they've learned, what they'll do differently. So yes, it's not always easy, particularly for early adopters.
Mm. And I guess to the other question, we heard about the climate science as well, but also a lot of the discussion here and over the years has been about making money too, or at least, you know, reducing cost maybe might be another way of looking at it.
Yeah, definitely. Look, even though we were quite excited about the reduced emissions that our farm would be, you know, by using solar, it was actually driven by a business decision to reduce our diesel bill and be a bit more energy resilient. So, you know, a lot of renewables can bring really, really fantastic savings to farms, and it is about, it has to make sense in a business way, but also, you know, if we can reduce carbon and continue to trade internationally and show that we're managing our emissions, that's a really positive step for agriculture as well.
How many people actually talk about it just in terms of the economics and not really about the emissions or not really about the environment or climate change?
Look, I'd say most farmers who speak on our stage would talk about the business aspect of it first. There are some businesses that see that, you know, reducing your carbon footprint, being more green, having a greener product is beneficial for business as well. So, you know, Seesaw Wines are here earlier, Maggie Jarrett, you know, they really wanted to address climate impacts because they could see climate change already impacting their farm, as we have as well. But in the end, mostly it needs to be work for business, and then that environmental aspect is very important as well. But we need to make sure that it's a strong economic case for farmers to adopt renewables.
Yeah, and we also heard that discussion here about some of the other offshoots of that, like biofuels, as we'll be talking to Andrew Whitelaw about that shortly as well. We'll also talk about some of that, some of the climate science too. When you're talking to farmers, are they worried? Are they worried about the climate? Are they worried about climate change? Are they worried about whether it's going to rain?
Yes, I think climate volatility is quite is becoming worse and worse. You know, more unpredictable seasons. It means you can't manage and plan as easily anymore. So farmers are concerned. Whether they believe, you know, it's human induced or they can do much about it is another story. But I do believe that they are being concerned that we're not having average seasons anymore. My late partner used to say, I'd die for an average year, because we just, you know, there are years that were up to 2020 that were too dry to plant a winter crop, followed by wet years that were so wet we didn't put cotton in for the first time in 20 years. So, you know, it's already impacting our profitability and our ability to produce food and fibre.
Karen, look, I know you're busy. You were just up on the stage. I'll let you get back to it. Thanks for joining us on the Country Hour.
Thank you so much.
It's coming up to 18 minutes past 12.
Every community has stories worth sharing. ABC Your Say is your chance to join the conversation. Tell us what's on your mind. Visit abc.net.au/yoursay.
And we were talking about the climate science with Karen just there a little bit as well. But we're joined now by Mark Howden, Professor Mark Howden, who's an emeritus professor at ANU and a long-time climate scientist and very well known. We've actually had him on the Country Hour a couple of times over the years. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And your discussion, really, you were saying that people need to get away from this idea that when you're talking about climate science or climate change and global warming, that you're talking about a belief system. You're just saying, you're a scientist, we're talking about science. That's what we're seeing. These things are hard-baked. We're seeing them now. They're scientifically fact.
That's right. The sort of language of belief system sort of raises questions about the veracity or certainty, whereas in fact the science is very clear, and that is climate change is already happening. It's caused by humans, and further greenhouse gas emissions will cause more climate change, and it's rock solid science.
Something you spoke about today was the advances that climate change and what that can mean for opportunities for renewables and for farmers. So I guess, can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, like anything, change brings positives and negatives, and winners and losers, and so farmers obviously want to be the winners out of this, and that's challenging because generally speaking, climate change is not going to be friendly for Australian agriculture as it's practiced now. So what it will tend to do is increase risk in agriculture, so we get more really wet conditions and more really dry conditions, and overall much hotter conditions, and all of those can cause problems for agriculture. So one of the ways of managing that risk is putting in things like renewables in agriculture, which provide a solid and steady income stream, which allows you to defray that risk across your enterprise. And so overall, you're reducing your risk, which allows you to invest more. Because if you increase your risk, everything else being equal, you will invest less, and in the long term, you'll produce less as a result. So risk, managing that risk is really important for the long-term future of agriculture.
Yeah, you were talking about, you know, farmers should not necessarily just think about producing food or fibre, but now maybe they actually, and we are seeing it, talk about using the farm for energy generation.
Yeah, absolutely. And so in a sense, what we should be thinking about, you know, people have started off with talking about green energy, and then they start talking about clean energy. And I would actually just start talking about energy and farming energy. And so taking out all of those other sort of baggage that might come with different conversations, and just seeing farming energy as an integrated part of farming in Australia where you can do it. And that's both to provide electricity for your own purposes, for export purposes, and sometimes for processing of things like, you know, dairy milk. And so what I would actually see is Australian farmers should actually just start thinking about being not just grain farmers and livestock farmers, but also energy farmers.
And we are seeing that a bit in terms of the checks that people get for their wind farms particularly, or their solar panels and things like that. So that's happening now, but you just think there is more opportunity for that?
Absolutely. Almost every farm across Australia could be part of this energy revolution, because it is a revolution where across the globe, fundamentally changing how we produce energy and how we use energy, and Australia's farmers need to be part of that.
But they don't need to have panels or wind farms over every inch of the farm.
No, of course not. And so in fact, a solar panel is more than 20 times more efficient at converting solar energy than a plant is. And so solar panels are incredibly effective at generating energy, and so you don't need that many of them to generate as much energy, say, as a field of biofuel canola. So you know, using plants to generate energy is actually really inefficient compared with using solar panels to generate energy, or wind turbines, which allow you to keep on farming pretty much as you were.
And just personally, you have just gone fully electric. When I was actually on the phone to you recently, the electrician came through to give the final gas meter read of your fully electric home. Can you talk us through, I guess, how did that work, and what's it been like so far?
I think it's really important to walk the talk, and so progressively in our family we've been removing the fossil fuels from our systems, and just recently we disconnected from gas from the system, and so that was actually the final gas meter reading, and so we do as much as we can in our suburban block, and so we not only have lots of solar panels and a battery and electric vehicle, and everything's electrified in the house, like induction cooktop, etc. But we also try to maximise the amount of food that we produce on our quarter acre block, and it's actually makes so much sense to do that. And so almost every day we'll have something from the garden that is not only nice to eat, but it's also very nutritious, being, you know, completely fresh. And so I think there's a lot that average people can do, even those in apartments can do, that reduce their greenhouse gas footprint and make them have a happier and healthy lifestyle. And that's a great story.
You also went through some of the figures in terms of what we're seeing in the climate, and some of it was pretty alarming when you look at, you know, since the Industrial Revolution, in terms of the amount of warming we've seen. Maybe talk us through some of that and what you think actually net zero is, because people are a bit confused about that as well, because you put it in that context too. So, you know, how far have we come in terms of warming, and what needs to happen And why is net zero important?
So on a trend basis, we're almost now 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial temperature levels. And for most people, 1.5 degrees doesn't have a lot of context. So I'll give you a context. That is, our last ice age was around about 5 degrees colder than our historical temperatures. And that 5 degrees resulted in kilometres of ice over Europe and North America, and it resulted in our sea levels 120 metres below where they currently are. That's what 5 degrees does. So when we're talking about 1.5 degrees, it's roughly a third of an ice age's worth of temperature change, but obviously in the other direction. So we're heading currently towards about a 3 degree temperature change, which is like two-thirds of an ice age's worth of temperature change. And in the long term, that will fundamentally change the face of the Earth, just like the last ice age fundamentally changed the face of the Earth. So we need to be recognising that we're already causing huge amounts of climate change, which will have long-term consequences, and we need to be starting to take action. And increasingly, that action not only makes sense in terms of avoiding risk from climate change, but you can actually build in lots and lots of co-benefits, including those from putting renewables in our farms.
And we're seeing that in Europe at the moment. You talk about, you know, colossal changes and the amount of water in the rivers and these rolling heat waves of record temperatures on top of record temperatures.
Indeed, and so Europe is actually warming up quite fast, faster than most other continents, and what we're seeing is climate change cutting in really hard there. So, for example, there's rivers which are not flowing, which in the entire history, which goes back thousands of years, have never stopped flowing. We've seen fires which are at record levels. We've seen tens of thousands of people losing their lives because of the heat waves and having housing that's not suited to these high temperatures, and the list goes on. And so what we are encountering is that what used to be really nice places with mild and manageable and predictable temperatures are now no longer like that. And so we're bringing risk into our systems, and we're not responding as quickly as the risk is developing.
Well, that's a sobering thought, but I guess that's why you're saying we need to decarbonise and move to net zero. So we actually need to in the chart you showed today, it's like it's falling off a cliff. We have to get to that to actually claw back some of the carbon that we've got out there at the moment.
That's right. So when we emit a tonne of carbon or a year's worth of carbon, roughly speaking, a half of that will remain in the atmosphere for decades to millennia. And so it accumulates in the atmosphere. And the only way you can stop it from accumulating is by going to net zero. So even if you halve your emissions, really effective in terms of reducing your emissions, it still means it's going to be accumulating in the atmosphere, and it still means the temperature is going to go up. So the only way you can stop it is by going to net zero. So that's the science behind net zero. And of course, it's a huge challenge because we've got our systems are built on, in many cases, fossil fuels as part of our development path, but they don't have to be like that in the future. We actually have better options now for things like electricity and transport, and so we can actually go on a development path which is much, much cleaner than we have in the past. And also, developing countries don't have to go through a dirty fossil fuel development stage because they can actually leapfrog that and go straight into a clean development stage without the health problems, without a lot of the other problems that we're seeing. And so, so there is actually a really positive story here, which is actually about better development paths by going using renewable energy and smart technologies.
And yet a lot of the politicians we talk to on the ABC and elsewhere talk about this idea of ditching the idea of a move to net zero. That must be dismaying you when you talk, as you say, you're talking about the science.
Well, as a scientist, you get increasingly frustrated because we've had enough information to make good investment decisions, good government policy for at least 20 years now. And so it is frustrating. And in particular, what you're seeing here is the power of the existing industries, the incumbents, which inherently have a sort of view of the world as it used to be, and the voices that have a really positive view of the future are often small and weak in comparison, and they're the ones who have a view of the future as the world as it could be, and that view of the future can actually be incredibly positive. And so at the moment we've got a real sort of political a discourse which is weighted against the changes that we could be making, and as a result we're making those changes much more slowly and less efficiently and effectively than we could otherwise do. And that's actually not good for Australia. So we're suffering economically because of that holding back, and we're suffering in industries like agriculture which haven't been able to do that change in risk management in the way that they need to. And in part that's because the Australian governments and other governments now are disinvesting in research and development, both in emission reductions and in climate adaptation. And that just doesn't make much sense in a fast-changing world.
Mark Howden is Emeritus Professor at ANU and climate scientist of long standing. Thanks for joining us on the Country Hour.
Thank you.
Enjoy the conference. It's coming up to 28 minutes past 12.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. With interest rates on hold, a sigh of relief or a gasp of apprehension about further rate hikes ahead? How much economic pain can Australians take, and can Labor turn the polls around in time? More than 169 killed and thousands still missing in Colombia as the race to find survivors in the rubble continues. And Phillip Island's famous fairy penguins will be some of the first to be vaccinated against the deadly H5 strain of bird flu. Join me for The World Today.
You're listening to the New South Wales Country Hour, broadcasting from Orange, from the National Renewables in Ag Conference. Speakers in the background at the moment, up on the stage, probably about 300 or so people, nearly 400 people, Emily, here today. So a good turnout. I think they're pretty happy with that.
Great turnout. Yeah. Lots of different conversations being had about what you can do, what you can't do.
We'll talk to some farmers in a moment, and an economist as well, and look at some of the further issues here at the conference. But right now it's time to get some news headlines. Adam's story is there. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Michael. The state government's seeking more information from the Therapeutic Goods Administration over its move to suspend the sale of a defibrillator, which is used in the state's ambulances. The TGA is temporarily halting the sale of the device, which is used in 1,400 ambulances across the state. Now, the authority hasn't provided any more details, but says there is a chance the three-month ban, which comes into effect from the 25th of August, could become permanent. And now the health minister says a review of the device's failures hasn't led to any patient safety issues, so he is seeking more information. Melongate continues to be an issue, with the opposition leader again calling on the Prime Minister to apologise over comments he made about melons gifted to him by his Japanese counterpart. The Prime Minister's already rejected suggestions he was disrespectful when he spoke about the melons while making hand gestures in front of his chest in a podcast interview last month. Meanwhile, the Shadow Home Affairs Minister has made a complaint to police about the apparent leaking of confidential correspondence between Australian and Japanese officials. This relates to a diplomatic note that reportedly suggested the Japanese government sees no ill intention over Mr. Albanese's remarks. But James Pattinson says that such information is private information between the two governments and should not have been leaked to the media. Westpac says most homeowners will still likely be better off at the end of the current house price slump. The bank is predicting falls of up to 10% nationally. I think ANZ was predicting 15. And that takes into account a softening that's already occurred in Sydney and Melbourne. The bank's chief economist says despite the decline, house prices are still a hell of a lot higher than what they were 4 years ago.
Yes, that's right.
And did you do your census, Michael?
Oh, yeah, it's to be done.
I did mine this morning. Yeah. Despite reading stories all day saying it was census night, I forgot to do it. Anyway.
If you do the electronic one, you've got a period of grace to do it.
Yes, but they will start following up next week. And the fine, $364 a day.
Yeah. But I think they say, you just say, oh, yeah, I'm going to get to it, and they say, okay.
Yeah. I think those are a bit of leniency.
Got to do it eventually. They're a bit. Yeah. Well, I think that the you're supposed to do the paper one day. There's a bit of leniency on the electronic one. Not to say that it's not a worthwhile thing that everyone should be doing, of course.
I think it's a very important thing.
Yes, because it's about roads, schools, universities, funding for a whole bunch of stuff.
The needs of the people.
That's right. What the people want. That's right.
I'll let you get back to your conference, mate. Just drifting off into
Thanks for
nowhere.
That, Adam.
All right.
No. Let's find out what's happening in the weather. Afreen Hussain's at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
So not much happening. Well, it's cool here in Orange. It's not been raining very much or anything. It's cloudy. I guess it's there's not much rain around.
Yeah, so that might change this afternoon. So we do have a cold front and trough moving across the state today, and that will bring some showers and thunderstorms through today and into early tomorrow. We're not looking at any significant rainfall with that system, so mostly just a millimetre or two, but the highest total is likely to be about the southern and central ranges and in the Hunter with 5 to 10 millimetres, and likely to see that falling of snow on the Alpine ranges with the snow level falling to about 1,200 metres today. But from tomorrow, once that system moves through, we do have a high-pressure system and a ridge developing across the state, so return to dry and benign conditions later in the week and into the weekend.
So that high-pressure system coming in, and that will be a feature for how long, do you think?
Yeah, so probably towards the latter part of this week and into the weekend and next week as well, looking pretty dry, but we might see some coastal showers developing as that ridge brings some onshore flow then.
Right, okay, so yeah, so that high will be a feature for a number of days after we get a few showers in the next day or so, and then the high is going to sit there. Do we know for how long? Is it going to be like 5 or 6 days like we saw like a week ago or so?
Yeah, that's right. So it's going to be moving across South Australia over the weekend and towards Tasmania, and then into early next week it starts to move off into the Tasman Sea, but it continues to have that ridge over much of the state, so keeping things fairly settled for the next week or so.
Fairly settled for the next week. So not much rain, no rain in it?
Yeah, not much rain. We're looking at a few millimetres as this cold front moves through today. But then over the next week, it will be a few coastal showers, but not looking at anything significant for the next 7 days.
So, yeah, just a few coastal showers and only talking a couple of millimetres.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, okay. All right, but cool. It's pretty cool, so stay pretty cool, will it?
Yeah, with that ridge developing, we might see some temperatures warming up slightly, so a bit warmer than average, but otherwise, yeah, not seeing too much.
In terms of moisture. All right, thanks for that.
No worries. Thanks, Michael.
Afreen Hussain at the Bureau there. It's coming up to 24 minutes to one.
Lodging on the blind side.
If we truly are a sporting nation, then we need a section in the census about our sporting interests and affiliations.
Why is this?
I know. Ryan HG.
Surely a write-in campaign would draw the attention of organisers to the need for these questions. And maybe you mark it up yourself.
Or just up the top of it. You know, I love Manly. Foz is doing a great job.
And I get all my rugby league from Bludging on the Blind Side.
Ryan HG.
Saturday from 12 on ABC Listen.
Sunrise is cutting 78 jobs in its operations in the Riverina. The company employs about 650 people at its processing operation in the Riverina, and 92 positions will be cut or changed. Sunrise plans to downsize production in its Leeton mill from a 24/7 operation to run 16 hours a day for just 5 days a week. And processing at the Deniliquin mill will be cut from around the clock to just 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. Jackie Kruger, General Manager of Leeton Shire Council, told Rachel Holdsworth it's a blow to the communities of Leeton and Deniliquin.
Our immediate reaction is to think of the impacted families. We've got 10 families in Leeton, and Deniliquin has 68 families, which is significant, and our hearts go out to them. Our hearts also go out to the communities of Leeton and Deniliquin, because when we do have major businesses doing these kind of restructures, it has flow-on impacts in the town. So we will work proactively with Sunrise and the impacted staff to see if there are other businesses in Leeton that can absorb them. But of course, we've got 10 families impacted, and so let's say that's probably 30 people you could potentially lose from your town. Deniliquin, of course, will have a far greater impact, and it's going to be difficult for that community as well. It's squarely as a result of government water reform and government policy. Sunrise is a very strong business, homegrown out of Leeton. That's where it all started. And it's farmers in the Riverina that got together to develop Sunrise, and it has grown into a major multinational company and a great success story. Unfortunately, government water reform has impacted the rice industry, and particularly since 2023, when the federal government brought in the Restoring Our Rivers Act, amendments to the Act, that really had a very severe impact on the community. And these buybacks that have been happening have really skewed the price of water and made water less available for annual croppers like rice farmers and cotton farmers. So water policy, effectively the government, is squarely responsible for this decision that Sunrise has had to make lately. We believe strongly that the whole Murray-Darling Basin plan should take a far better place-based approach, and there should be far more engagement at the local level, looking at what those environmental goals that we're trying to achieve, and together looking at innovative ways of reaching them without having to decimate farms and decimate communities in the process.
Peter Herman is the president of the Rice Growers Association and a rice grower himself, and he told Sally Bryant it's a sad day for the district, but future is still bright for the industry.
Well, I'd say the rice industry internally has never been stronger. Our market partners are very well placed to capitalise on the terrific rice we produce. We're producing more of it per hectare than we ever have, and that's due to our varieties that have improved and our agronomics and automation. In these senses, it's never been a better time to be a rice grower. So we're looking forward to the future, and we need more people to understand what a great story we have in the rice industry. And principally, all we need to do is keep adding inputs. Now, we're using less water per hectare, per megalitre. Our carbon footprint is world's lowest by a mile, and has been and is by any benchmarking. So there's no question about our commercial creds, and there's no question about our environmental credibility. The only question is coordinating the use of natural resources to make the most of these opportunities.
Now, rice growers mill rice overseas. This has evolved over time with less Australian rice. Will this sector of the business continue to grow with less jobs in the Riverina?
Absolutely.
Right.
Australian varieties and the way we produce them here is unique, and the assets that we have to process that rice to value add are unique. And I'd suggest they won't be replaced by overseas production. So as much rice as we can foreseeably produce in Australia, we will continue to value add. And the value we're adding is profound. It's in the regions. These are jobs that range right through to from mechanical engineering through to marketing jobs through to high-end electrical jobs. So this is very sophisticated machinery. We're producing leading edge in packaged products nowadays. So it's an exciting product range, an exciting growth picture, and yeah, we're motivated to make the most of it.
Peter Herman is the president of the Rice Association. Sunrise Group CEO Paul Serra said in a statement the company will continue to advocate to government about the impacts of its current water policies. Sunrise flagged the cuts last month, of course, attributing them to a reduction in the rice supply due to drought conditions and water policy. You're listening to the Country Hour, broadcasting from the National Renewables in Agriculture Conference here in Orange. It's coming up to 17 minutes to one.
Evenings with Renee Crush.
Every suburb has a story.
About 5.5 years ago, I was very close to living in the car with my two kids. That's how close I got.
Yeah.
So I can't complain about what I have and what I don't have. I'm just happy with what I got.
Good for you. How did you turn things around, Michael?
Without getting too emotional, just had to do it for the kids. Simple as that.
Evenings with Renee Crush from 7.
A lot of people are finding it pretty damn tough, and it's very inspiring that you're able to dig deep and find a way out.
Across ABC New South Wales.
Turning to solar energy now, we're joined by Libby Skipworth. Libby's a farmer from the Lake Cajelico area, and for some time now she's been working with Graphite Energy, an energy storage technology innovator, to develop a renewables precinct that supports regenerative farming practices. She joins us now with her husband, Peter. Good afternoon.
Hello, good evening.
So I guess can you start by telling us a bit about this precinct and what you've been working on over the last couple of years?
So we've been really fortunate to work with Graphite Energy for a long time now. And because of that opportunity, we've been able to spot some potential to expand on their concept and look for opportunities both for the community and for us as farmers. Just what else can we do at that site? So looking to build on the opportunities there and create regenerative agricultural inputs and continue to support our community.
And so what about, so it's storing energy as well as regen farming, so how do you do one and then the other? You like maybe explain that, how that happens.
Okay, so Graphite Energy, their technology is a thermal energy storage technology, and that's evolved out of their initial solar technology. So we're now looking to put a PV system in there up to 5 megawatts, and then using that system to then power value add systems. We've been fortunate, Regional Development has supported us with some funding to develop a pilot plant to produce. We're planning to produce a protein meal and a fish emulsion, a biostimulant from carp, which is an invasive native species. Huge issue when you live in a lake and a waterway. So they're the kinds of things that we're trying to do. So leaning into the opportunities that arise in renewable energy.
And Peter, I might bring you in here. So what sort of farming, apart from the fish and the meal, what sort of other farming dovetails in with it as well?
Well, being a broadacre farmer and potential irrigation farmer, we want to look at, can we on a smaller scale still farm? We're trying to develop a agrivoltaic system of our own. We've set up a small grid which hasn't got solar panels on it to do shading studies and that, to see whether we could actually grow more rather than just graze sheep under low panels, whether we could lift them up into the agrivoltaic scenario and we could farm more broadacre style, get tractors under and do that sort of thing. And so this, once we do shading studies on what will grow under there, or whether we can do aquaculture under them, or whether we do something like chickens or other stock. So rather than just sheep grazing alone, we're looking at whether we can get into more horticulture or something like that with the microbe climate and everything that the solar panels will provide.
Because that has been, that has been the problem in some of these models, is that they say that it excludes certain types of agriculture, but then other people say, oh no, it doesn't, we can do it, we can do different things.
You can do almost anything under panels agriculture-wise. It really comes down to what the PV developers are willing to go with. For many of them, there's tight margins on smaller developments. And it's about risk. Because they don't understand the model, they're overly concerned about what the impacts of that operation might be under their panels. The modelling overseas shows that if you're growing something under the panels, it actually increases their efficiency, so they get more power out of the panels, particularly in these hotter areas, because when the panels get over a certain temperature, and I'm not sure what that is, but when they get over a certain temperature, they actually start reducing in their production. So agrivoltaics will actually contribute to the energy output as well as keeping the land in its productive use as farming.
Is this have you seen this be done before?
It's not being done a great deal in Australia. There's quite a number of small-scale projects around. There's various projects that have tried. I think there's some pears in Victoria. There's a few people trying grapes. But there's quite a bit of sheep grazing. There's a little bit of cattle under panels, but they have their own challenges, and anyone who's got Dorfus knows there's challenges there as well. So there's some small-scale trials going on. We're sort of talking at a much bigger scale, which is getting people to understand the scale and getting developers to come on board and contribute to that it's one of the challenges.
Well, that was going to be my next question, I suppose, seeing as though this hasn't happened on this scale, particularly in regards to the horticulture potentially happening underneath these solar panels. What are some of those other challenges that you have faced just trying to get this off the ground?
For us, it's been we've been on a pretty steep learning curve. So in some of the projects, I mean, I've had to read the Fisheries Management Act. I'd never thought I'd have to read that as a broadacre farmer.
Oh, that'll be some light reading.
Yes.
Bedtime reading, yeah.
So there's all sorts of things. We're on a really steep learning curve, and as most farmers would know, we already have to be across so many things. So we're just sort of adding to that to, because, you know, just keep life simple and add another layer of complexity to it.
I think one of the biggest hurdles at this point in time is the guys to come on, you get to see them and they want to put in a solar PV. They want to do as cheap as possible to maximise their output. And when we say to them we want to add some extra to this infrastructure, they're very hesitant because that's adding to their bottom line. And trying to get them over the line and say, well, we think we can improve your bottom line in the summer, because I think it's mid-20s or somewhere there, solar panels will start to reduce, and out where we are it gets to 40 quite regularly. So I think that's the major hurdle at this stage, is getting a developer to understand that we're all for them to make a dollar. We just want to keep our dirt more productive rather than just have it pigeonholed into just running cheaper.
It's a good point, actually, because quite often you hear with this, with the res zones and also transmission lines, that's a common theme, is it, where they say we're not really bringing, you know, the company's not really bringing the farmer along with them in a lot of cases, and you sort of had to.
Yeah, well, that's true. Where we sit right beside a 66 kV line, but we know to feed back down that line about 100 k's away, the switchgear won't let it feed the other way. Just as we've heard this morning, all that gearing is one way. It's not bi-directional. So that limits what we can feed back into the grid. So this is why we've went, well, we need to use that solar on site and be able to back up the grid, but also what can we do with that solar? So
not an easy conversation to have. And what sort of, I mean, does it have to be higher to grow things underneath? I mean, maybe, what are the practicalities of it?
Yeah, there's certainly got to be much higher if you're looking at using machinery underneath. And depending on what your operation is, we'll have to look at the scale of the machinery and some of the other opportunities that potentially are there with robotics and those sorts of things. They're a whole new field for us as well, but whether there's some small scale robotics that would be useful underneath them and how we actually manage that. So getting your trades, your skills, those sorts of things in is a big challenge. We're considered an outer regional area, and we're often don't get the attention that we deserve as a place that could generate opportunities for people to try things. Versus too hard to get there.
But you get plenty of sun and it's pretty
yes,
hot there.
Yes, that's so how Graphite Energy ended up there. They had when they first started out, they were given the option of a number of I think four sites around New South Wales, and it was about how much sun you got through the day to utilise in their original energy concept, which was about concentrated solar.
And we've got to go to markets in a moment, which we will do, but what are you growing now and what are you thinking about growing?
Well, currently we aren't growing anything. We're setting up for our shade study under our agriculture.
You've got sheep, haven't you? Is that right?
Sorry?
You've got sheep.
Oh, on our farm, we run sheep. Yeah, we do all the cereal cropping and run cattle and try everything.
Yep.
But in the agrivoltaic space, we'll set up a shade and study, and we'll just probably go into some, you know, pumpkins, some spring sort of stuff. We'll sort of shotgun that and put a lot of stuff in to see what reacts under the shading study to see what grows best and all that, and what width we need our panels apart for light inception.
So do you have to pay for that, the study, or is the company paying?
No, we've got a really strong team that we're working with, and one of our team members is Emma Aliff, who was the 2021 Young Farmer of the Year also a principal at Summit Ag, which is a large agronomy firm in southern New South Wales. We've got an aquatic ecologist, Dr. Adam Kersey, who Dr. Fish, as he's better known, so us. And we've been mentored by Graphite Energy CEO as well. So we're really fortunate in the team that we've been able to put together. And they're all a bit irreverent, so they all like thinking a little bit outside the box, which is lovely.
Okay, well, we'll leave it there, but appreciate your time on the Country Hour today. It's coming up to 7 minutes to one. $50, thank you. First up, casino cattle.
Good afternoon. It was 1,400 head yarded, which was down by 400. Young cattle were well supplied and a good penning of cows. Quality of the young cattle improved with increased numbers of yearlings and weaners through the sale, carrying more condition and also extra weight. The market was firm to 10 cents dearer for the weaner steers, mainly quality related. They sold from 410 to 540, medium weight average at 485. Restocker weaner heifers 10 to 20 cents dearer, with extra competition putting a floor in the market. They sold from 320 to 436, medium weights averaging 390. Trade vealers were 20 cents dearer. They sold from 350 to 400 cents. Restocker yearling steers topped at 494. Not a lot of grown steers and heifers. 3 score bullocks topped at 404 cents to process, and the grown heifers up to 400. Cow market held firm. 2 score medium weights, 305 to 350. 3 scores averaged 354. Heavy cows, 374 to 379 cents. Heavy bulls topped at 412. Doug Robson at Casino.
To Kakor sheep and lambs.
Good afternoon. Numbers halved for 3,000 lambs. Quality varied, with some trade and heavies in good condition, while the remainder lacked finish, and there were mainly trade and heavies offered. Medium and heavy trades were firm to 4 cheaper, 20 22 kilos, 253 to 260, 22 to 24, 271 to 290, averaging 11.70 cents. Heavyweights were firm, 24 to 26, 290 to 295, 26 plus, 318 to a top of 347, averaging 1,060 to 1,160 cents. Mutton numbers fell by 600 for 1,000. Quality was mixed. Prices were firm to 15 dearer and more in places. Medium merino ewes sold from 181 to 222, averaging 820 to 960 cents. Heavy first cross ewes, 215 to 308, averaging 860 cents. And this has been Rob Pearce from the CTLX Car Call.
Let's go to Cowra Shipping Lambs now. Rob Pearce is there again. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael. Lamb numbers fell by 400 for 2,700. Quality continues to be good for the trade and extra heavyweights. There were mainly heavies penned, a run of trades, and 600 new seasons were offered. Trade new seasons were firm, 22 to 24, 280 to 291, averaging 1175. Trade old lambs lifted 10, 22 to 24, 276 to 290, averaging 1170. Heavyweights firm to 9 dearer, 24 to 26, 310 to 314, 26 to 30, 310 to 320, 30 plus, 340 to a top of 377, averaging 1,070 to 1,200 cents. And mutton numbers fell for only 370, quality improved, prices lifted for heavy sheep. Heavy merino ewes sold from 273 to 275, averaging 875. Heavy first cross ewes, 228 to 312, averaging 855 cents. And that's been Rob Pearce from Cowra.
Yes, sheep and lambs.
Good afternoon. Numbers eased slightly for 5,115 mixed quality lambs. There are a few store lambs and plenty of trade weights, but some were lacking cover. Heavy lambs were still well represented, and there was a good line of merinos. All the usual buyers are operating this week, and the market surged $20 to $25 a head. Trade lambs 20 to 24 kilos sold from 230 to 309, and most range between 1140 and 1200 cents. The 24 to 26 kilos, 292 to 328 to average 1220. Heavy lambs 26 to 30 kilos, 310 to 360 or 1140 cents on average, with extra heavies topping at 373. The trade merinos range from 200 to 266 or 1070 cents. Mutton numbers dropped to only 1500. Light and medium weights were dearer by $15 to $20. Heavy mutton over 30 kilos eased slightly. The medium weight ewes are 178 to 226. Heavy crossbred ewes reached 288 and merinos 266. And most range from 780 to 840.
To Mossvale Cattle.
Good afternoon. Numbers dropped back to just over 1,200. It was a very wintry yarding, with the exception of the outstanding grain-fed cattle and vealers. Heavy export steers and heifers were limited, and it was a step down in quality over the cow run. Lightweight steers back to the paddock were firm, 450 to 582. Feeder steers lightweight, 470 to 544. Medium-weight feeder steers picked up 3 cents, 510 to 542. Veal at the top end jumped 20 cents, selling between 525 and 582. Trade steers sold 10 cents stronger, 526 to 586. Trade heifers were back 15, 520 to 568. Heavy steers and bullocks, very few to quote, 420 to 5.28. Heavy cows sold 10 cents cheaper, 3.87 to 4.06. And planter cows slipped up to 30 cents, 2.80 to 3.76. I'm Leanne Dux at MLA.
And Singleton Cattle.
Good afternoon. High rainfall totals, particularly in the Central Tablelands district, saw added buying strength in the Singleton market as agents penned 630 cattle. Cheaper trends of previous weeks were stopped and reversed, which saw light steer calves improve by 40 to 64 cents a kilo and more in places, selling in a big range of 335 to 592 cents. Heavier weaner steers weighing 291 kilos topped the market at 596. Light weaner heifers followed suit to be 40 and 50 cents a kilo better off, traded between 300 and 536 cents. Prime Euro calves, the local butcher trade, made from 526 to 544. Not many yearlings to quote. A few penfuls of prime Angus bullocks, 4 and 6 tooth, around 660 kilos to process, made from 474 to 480. Heavy grown heifers topped at 420. Around 120 cows off at all dearer. Lighter two scores up by 18, 270 to 340. 40, heavy 3 and 4 scores traded between 3.46 and 4.02 cents. Angus Barlow for MLA at Singleton.
We're broadcasting today from Orange. We'll broadcast again tomorrow, looking more at seasonal conditions, but also more on renewables as well, Emily.
Absolutely, and we'll catch you again tomorrow afternoon.
Between 12 and 1, talk to you then.